On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, Americans. Donald Trump may become the president of your country. If that happens and you decide to get the hell out of there, might I suggest moving to Cape Breton Island?
I can state one thing with absolute confidence. If Donald Trump becomes president, I'm moving to Canada.
If any Republican gets nominated, I'm going to move to Canada with my entire family.
Like Canada wants them. Like the first thing Canada wants is all these Americans coming.
Yes, a few of our fellow Americans are threatening to move north if a certain Republican candidate wins the presidency. In a moment, we'll talk to a Canadian who is rolling out the red carpet with his website, Cape Breton If Trump Wins. But first, it is a close race for Democrats and Republicans in California's primary race, according to a new poll from USC. Hillary Clinton leads 45-37% over Bernie Sanders. Donald Trump is up just 37-30% over Ted Cruz. The frontrunners do line up with what we've seen in other states, but there are some surprises in this data. The reasons why California Republicans support Trump aren't all what you might expect. And the racial gap we've seen nationwide between Clinton and Sanders voters is far less pronounced here. Dan Schnur is director of USC's Jesse Unruh Institute of Politics, and he's here to break it down. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So Bernie Sanders, he needs an overwhelmingly big win in states going forward, especially in California. And so what does this poll say about his chances?
Well, a couple of things for Bernie Sanders here. Number one, he's trailing by 8 points, but that's actually half the margin that Clinton was beating him when we polled on the race back in the fall. So he's making up ground. The question is whether he's making it up fast enough. The second thing for Sanders and his supporters is that while Clinton is beating him fairly handily among Democratic primary voters, he's doing extremely well, exceptionally well among independents. So the most important thing for Sanders on Election Day, not surprisingly, is as high a turnout as possible, not only to get his younger supporters out, but to get independents as well.
So independents get to vote in the Democratic primary, but not in the Republican primary.
Precisely.
Okay. How is he doing with Latinos? That is a big voting bloc here in California.
It's really interesting, and you mentioned this in the introduction, Madeline, that while Sanders has been beaten very, very decisively among minority voters, African-American and Latino voters in other states, in this state, the margin's a lot closer. Clinton still wins among minority voters, but California minorities do not appear to have the same strength of historical allegiance to the Clintons that they do in other parts of the country. So while Sanders is losing this vote, he's making a race of it.
Mm. Well, yeah. So she had 67% of the Latino vote in 2008 among the Democrats. Now it's in the low 50s. Why the drop?
The honest truth is we don't know. Mm-hmm. I've talked to both the Democratic end of our polling team, and so you and your listeners know we actually have a bipartisan polling team, a Democratic and a Republican national firm, as well as Republican and Democratic in-state political consultants. And the best we have to offer on this is that generally Clinton has done best among minority voters in other states because, number one, of strong memories of her husband's presidency, and number two, strong allegiances that she's built up over the years, and one, because California is a more mobile society, and number two, because of Sanders' appeal in a state like this one, while she's winning among minorities, her support isn't as strong here as in other places.
Now, Latino Republicans in California do not like Donald Trump.
Right, and that shouldn't come as much surprise. What's a little bit more surprising is how close Trump is running to Ted Cruz among Republican primary voters who are Latino and Latina. That said, it is a very, very small sample, as you might suspect, and so it's probably not all that smart to draw huge conclusions from those numbers just because they are so small.
Okay. Where does Trump do well in California?
This is very interesting. Ted Cruz does best among Republican primary voters who are traditional Republicans. He does well in the Central Valley. He does well in Southern California outside of L.A. And demographically, he tends to do better with traditional Republican constituencies. Geographically, at least, Trump does better in areas that have not historically voted for Republican candidates, coastal areas, the Bay Area, and, you know, as has been his wont in other states, Trump is definitely drawing from a much less traditional Republican constituency.
So less traditional being, who are these voters then?
These demographically, there's not a real skew to them. Geographically, he tends to be drawing from the state's larger urban centers, which, as you know, historically leaned Democratic. Mm-hmm. One thing that we believe is helping both Trump and Sanders in the state is later this week, Madeline will be releasing numbers on voters' opinions on trade-related issues and on immigration-related issues as well. And both Trump and Sanders, because they are so outspoken against expanded trade agreements between the U.S. and other countries, seem to be benefiting. That has helped Sanders cut into Clinton's lead among minority voters in California, and it's allowed Trump to reach out to economically disaffected voters who haven't historically voted Republican.
Interesting. So Californians then, or a big proportion of them, don't like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the idea of it.
Well, we'll be releasing the numbers on the trade agreements in particular later this week, but there's no question that those Californians who oppose expanded trade mm-hmm. tend to be clustering toward Trump in one primary and Sanders in the other.
So what does this mean for how many delegates he's likely to rack up? Because on the Republican side, it's an interesting apportioning rule whereby the delegates are apportioned per congressional district. And so if you win one district, you get all three delegates assigned to that district. And so if he's doing well in areas with higher population, it would seem that he would get more delegates.
Well, I'm afraid our poll doesn't give you a whole lot of guidance in that regard, because every single one of the 53 congressional districts counts exactly the same in the Republican primary. We simply don't have a large enough sample to see which districts Trump and Cruz and Kasich are doing well in. What I will tell you, though, is that Trump's lead in high single digits among all voters and by 1 point over Cruz among likely Republican voters isn't enough to give him a sufficiently large number of delegates to allow him to secure the party's nomination before the convention. So California Republicans, who've been waiting for about half a century to matter in a presidential primary, may not be able to pick their party's nominee this June, but it looks like they're poised, at least right now, leaning toward preventing Trump from achieving the nomination before the convention begins.
And does John Kasich factor at all in California?
Kasich's name recognition is so low in California, it's difficult to figure out how much of an impact he'll make and in what way. If he is still a candidate by June, obviously Californians will know a lot about him. But at this point, he's drawing 12% in the polls. It tends to cluster toward more moderate areas. But until voters get to know more about him, there's not much more that can be divined from that.
And what about the enthusiasm gap that we've heard so much about when it comes to the Democrats versus the Republicans?
Well, and to me, that's the most important finding that we have in this poll on both sides of the aisle. We have a situation where roughly one quarter of Republicans who are say that they will vote for Trump reluctantly in the fall if they're not supporting him now. But a full 25% of Republicans say that they will not vote for him in the fall. That is unheard of. And that, you know, points to the fairly hard ceiling that Trump seems to have on his level of support, not just in California, nationally. Between 35% and 40% of Republicans are willing to vote for him no matter what. But he hasn't yet demonstrated an ability to break beyond those numbers. And so if he is the party nominee, he faces a real threat with defections from Republicans, particularly Republican women. On the flip side, though, while Secretary Clinton doesn't face defections from Sanders supporters, there's a marked lack of enthusiasm among Sanders voters for Clinton. Overwhelmingly, they believe she will be the next president of the United States, but more than 40% of Sanders voters in our state's primary say that they will vote for her unenthusiastically in the fall. Now, that's not going to keep Hillary Clinton from winning California, but if you project that challenge out nationally, it suggests that Hillary Clinton's biggest goal in the fall with Sanders supporters is not to persuade them to vote for her rather than a Republican, because that's not going to be that hard. Her challenge, rather, is to motivate them, to get them excited and inspired enough to turn out for her rather than just sitting home.
Or maybe it's a negative motivation, that they dislike the Republican nominee so much they'll go to the polls.
Well, if you've been watching the Democratic primary speeches, and I know you have, you see that Clinton has come to exactly that conclusion. She makes some effort to motivate Sanders supporters with a positive inspirational message. But if you can't inspire someone aspirationally, you can frighten them about the prospect of the alternative. And that's something she's already begun to lay the groundwork for.
A vote is a vote is a vote. Dan Schnur, director of USC's Jesse M. Unruh Institute of Politics. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, for all of you Californians who are appalled at the idea of a Trump presidency, here's a solution. Move to Canada. One town in particular will welcome you, Cape Breton. That's an island in Nova Scotia on the far eastern side of Canada, jutting into the Atlantic Ocean. And Rob Calabrese, a radio DJ at 101.9, The Giant, is spearheading the Move to Cape Breton campaign. It initially started out as a joke, but now he's serious. And when I spoke with Rob earlier, he began by giving me his best pitch for why anyone would want to give up the LA sunshine for the Great White North.
What we have here is a beautiful island, which always ranks quite highly whenever travel magazines try to rank islands for beauty among the world. We're always near the top. We have a very rich culture with a very proud and vibrant First Nations community, or like an indigenous people, the Mi'kmaq. We have French-speaking communities on this little island. We have people who speak Gaelic here. And there's a very strong Celtic culture as well. It's an outdoorsy place. If you like doing stuff outside, hiking, fishing, whatever, then this is a great place to be.
Okay. That all sounds really good. What if I want to earn a living?
Well, that, of course, is the reason I think we're both here.
Yeah.
We're hemorrhaging people. We're losing people. And the reason is a struggling economy. However, that being said, there are plenty of opportunities. When you have a struggling economy and people start to leave, that means there are certain skill sets that are required. For example, any kind of medical technician or nurse or doctor, anyone in any medical field really, would have no problem whatsoever finding a place here. If you're in the IT industry, there are lots of opportunities here as well. Because of the shrinking population and aging population, there are a lot of, when this website started going nuts, a lot of people were saying, well, I have no succession plan for my business because my kids have left. Would any Americans like to buy my business? So there's lots of investment opportunities as well, as far as entrepreneurs go. Although we no longer have the huge industry of coal and steel, which sustained us for 200 years. So we're trying to find a new path, and we're looking for, I guess, a new kind of pioneer.
So your website meant to be a refuge for people who felt that, well, their country is going in the wrong direction here in the United States. That was initially somewhat of a joke?
It kind of was, yes. And the joke was on, I guess, it's not a joke on anyone in particular, but we hear the common threat of I'm moving to Canada every single time you guys have an election.
Yeah.
I know Donald Trump wasn't given much. People didn't think he had what it took to get us this far originally. So I thought I would launch the website before any kind of primaries took place in case he got creamed. Now that hasn't happened. And now that he has gained such momentum and being given such support, people are now getting really nervous and taking the website seriously.
So are you taking them seriously now? Is the website now serious?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I launched this website on February the 15th, which was a Monday. Monday evening, I got my first contact, which was a serious, in earnest inquiry. And from that second on, this was a serious endeavor.
And how many have you had serious inquiries?
There's been about a million unique visitors to the site as far as questions on how to get into Cape Breton. We've had about 5,000. And these are actual, these are not people joking around or having a laugh. They're asking about the immigration process. They're asking about the housing market. They're asking about the economic environment.
And these are definitely people who are asking because of the election.
Well, the ones who choose to reveal that to me, because you can send a message of whatever you want. Many of them do reference Donald Trump winning. Or some say, well, what if Hillary wins? Or what if Ted Cruz wins? Or some say, do you know what? I've been actually thinking about this for a long time, and this is just the little nudge that I needed to find out more.
Why is it that people aren't just moving there? Why do you have to have this campaign? What is it about Cape Breton? I mean, the way you described it, it sounds like a really great place to live.
The only thing I can think of is, and I've always thought this, people just don't know we exist.
Hmm. Yeah, you're way off out there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're clinging to the edge of North America here. We're going to fall off at any moment if our grip is not as tenacious as always. But people just don't know we're here. And I just always thought if people knew that we were here and what we have and the way we live, a lot of people would think, you know what? I think that could be for me.
Okay, let's end with you telling us one of your favorite things or your favorite thing to do in Cape Breton.
Well, I'm a dad. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And you can go to a beach on a nice summer day and there's nobody on the beach. It's Aww. Empty, and it's not because there's
Sounds
no
Sounds a little
people
sad,
now.
Rob. Sounds a little sad.
Well, and I should continue. It's not because our population is low. It's because there are beaches everywhere. Like, this is an island, and it's actually, physically, Cape Breton is unique because it's an island, but there is an inland sea inside the island. It's actually Canada's largest inland sea. Hmm. So it's you can go, and there's islands in a sea, in an island, in the sea. So there's plenty of places and secluded spots to swim or have lobsters, which is a very big industry here. And the best thing about Cape Breton is for sure the community that you're going to be getting yourself into. And it's great, and it will appreciate you.
Rob Calabrese of 101.9 The Giant in Nova Scotia. Check out his website, cbiftrumpwins.com. Rob, thanks.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
So we'd love to hear from you. Are you planning to move to Canada if a certain candidate wins the election? Have you ever known anyone who made good on that threat? And why is it always Canada? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the best show on TV you are not watching, and why lesbian characters keep getting killed off. Our TV segment is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The creator of a cult favorite TV show has apologized to fans for killing off a character. Spoiler alert, Lexa, a popular lesbian character on The 100 on The CW, was killed earlier this month after she consummated her relationship with another woman, the series lead Clark. Well, that just enraged fans, and it prompted several entertainment outlets to explore what some are calling a troubling trend, and that is offing lesbian characters on television. Well, it's time to talk about that in our regular TV segment with June Thomas, culture critic for Slate. Welcome back, June.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, first, tell us about The 100, because not a lot of people watch it. So what is this about?
It's an amazing show. It really deserves a much bigger audience. It's very reminiscent, actually, in lots of ways, with Battlestar Galactica. It started as a show that was very straightforward in a way. You know, it's the future. The Earth's been in tatters. A few survivors went up into essentially a series of space stations and survived in space. But then the space station was dying. So they sent 100 young people. Hey, they all happen to be gorgeous, down to Earth. And those 100 young people were going to, you know, reacquaint themselves with the world that their ancestors had left behind.
And well, one of them was Lexa.
One of them was Clark. Lexa was one of the grounders, one of the people they found on the Earth. Okay. There's a whole series of clans. They actually found out that humans had survived on Earth. And so there's this whole series of clans, and there's warring and alliance making. And I have to admit that as much as I detest the trope of endlessly killing gay characters, but especially lesbian characters, because it is truly depressing. When you see it happen over and over and over again, it affects you. So as much as this disturbed me, I have to say that what happened in the show when Lexa died just launched this really fascinating new trend in the show. Mm-hmm. So whatever else happens with this, I really hope that the attention encourages people to check out the show, because it really is very smart and very fun. And it also happens to have all these attractive young people, but now also a few more normally magnificently attractive middle-aged people.
All right. So why, as you say, it's a trend that's been going on for some time, killing off lesbian characters. Why was this one such a flashpoint?
I think it was a matter of timing. I think there was another similar scene in a, let's just say, a zombie apocalypse show that maybe people may be familiar with. It's just, I think there's a certain amount of like, this has been happening over and over and over again. And even though, as you said, this show has a relatively small audience, it's an extremely vocal audience. There's a lot of, you know, Twitter talk and blog talk about these shows. And this relationship between Alexa and Clark, Clexa, as it was known, had been sort of brewing for so long. And finally, these two women who were both incredibly powerful, they're both leaders of their communities, despite being very young women. Mm-hmm. And then for it to just like this thing happens, this consummation, this happiness, and then seconds later, utter despair. And again, I think it was just a matter of just being exhausted with this just happening over and over again.
Yeah. All right, let's switch gears now and talk about The Real O'Neills. This is an ABC show. There's a gay teenager in this show who hopefully will not be getting killed off anytime soon. Tell us what you like about this character and this show.
The show is based very loosely on Dan Savage's life, very loosely in the sense that it's about a Chicago family where the father is a cop. And in the first episode, Kenny, the 16-year-old boy, came out as gay, and it was kind of started this snowball effect of other things in this family that are not quite as perfect as they like to present themselves to their church. You know, they're very, you know, they're really part of their church community. So that's different. It's mm-hmm. a good family that's a little bit flawed. But also just the presentation of what it's like to be a gay teenager now just feels very real. You know, there's been a long evolution of young gay characters. It's kind of surprising, but in many ways, you know, high schoolers have been the most positive gay characters we've seen on television. You know, started long before Glee, you know, My So-Called Life, The Fosters right now. But anyway, on The Real O'Neills, this kid is really coming to terms with what it means to be gay, to have dates with guys. How do you get information about how you talk to guys? You know, his family, who loves him and supports him, which is great to see, they don't really know how to do that. You know, his brother, who's just a little bit older than him and who's straight, tries to help him, for example, looking at porn. Now, that might seem crazy, but it also feels really real to me. And the show is also really funny, which is very important in a sitcom and is not always true, unfortunately.
Okay, and it's on ABC. That's interesting. That's on a regular broadcast channel. Also on ABC, another edition, the latest in the Shondaland land. It's called The Catch, and it premiered on Thursday. It stars Mireille Enos as Alice Vaughn. She's a private investigator, and Peter Krause as her fiancé. His name is Chris Hall. And let's play a clip from the first episode.
Christopher asked me to elope this morning.
Oh, my gosh.
What? Alice?
Yeah, he wanted me to just get on a plane with him and go to the Alps.
And you didn't go?
I have a job.
Oh, get out right now.
How?
I am serious. Honey, he asked you to marry him on an Alp.
One Alp. Just one. Well, there's a huge twist involved. Shall we give it away?
Let's. They did.
Okay.
So the fiancé has actually been cheating her. He's deceiving the person whose job is to catch deceitful people.
He is the deceitful person she's trying to catch.
He is. He's Mr. X. He's Mr. X, the guy who she and her companions at this, you know, fancy PI firm have been chasing. And it's crazy to give that away so early, but I think it also is kind of typical of Shondaland shows where they just throw so much story out there and so many twists. I think, you know, one of the things that we're dealing with now on television is that because networks have learned that you really can't have reruns anymore, they just kind of run these shows and then they go off the air. And one of the things that ABC has learned with the Shondaland, you know, franchises that just keep cycling through there is that if you have these shows which are different, but just have a lot in common, like pretty diverse casts with a lot of twists and surprises, that people, you know, might just sit down thinking, wait, this isn't How to Get Away with Murder. Oh, but I kind of recognize what's going on here, so I think I'll stick with it.
Yeah.
And this one is really particularly stylish. It's very visual. Certainly in the first episode, there was a lot that you really had to pay attention to and you wanted to. So, you know, it's a little bit different. It's not boring or over familiar, but it also feels like, oh, yeah, I see where this fits in on my TV schedule.
You liked it.
I did. I liked it certainly enough to want to watch and see how they, you know, how they got over this, the fact that they've, you know, given away this big twist so early. I don't know if it will be very many people's favorite show, but there's certainly a lot to watch there.
Speaking of favorite shows, Empire returns this week.
Finally.
This is the second half of the season, right?
Yeah.
So we're still in season two.
We are. After 4 months away, apparently it's still season two. Okay, whatever.
Okay, so are viewers still into this show?
I think that, again, this is all part of this not rerunning anymore. It's been a long time away. I think this is going to be a real test. People really like this show, but it's been gone. And, you know, it's the first thing that happened when Empire launched was that Cookie's back from being away, you know, in pokey for 17 years. Well, now Cookie's going to be back after being in sort of TV pokey for 4 months. And we'll see if people, you know, will return. I think they will, because I think this is a show that people are genuinely enthusiastic about. And, you know, the music is also there to bring people back. So I think, but it is kind of a risk.
Okay, we will see this week. Thanks, June.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
June Thomas, culture critic for Slate. Well, what about you? Are you one of them? Are you excited about the return of Empire? Or have you lost interest? It's been a long break. Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the first of our three-part series on people in South LA making a difference. Today, a police officer who spearheaded community policing.
It's all about, we wanted to see peace in the neighborhoods that we had a connection with and still had a connection with.
We'll meet Mike Carradine next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This week, we're going to tell you about three people who have a common goal. They're peacemakers, a cop, a former gang member, and an activist. All are working to stop gang-related violence in South LA. We're going to profile each of these people. They have different backgrounds, and that means the ways they make peace in their neighborhoods are also different. Peacemakers is a three-part series. It's part of our radio and web project, Below the 10, reporter David Weinberg's ongoing coverage of South LA. We begin today with the story of a police officer who was an early adopter of community policing.
Michael Carradine is a lieutenant with the Los Angeles Police Department. He's been on the force for 31 years, though he looks much younger than that. He has this way of drawing you in with his striking green eyes. Back when he was a beat cop in the late 80s and early 90s, the peak years of violent crime in Los Angeles, he worked in the Nickerson Gardens housing project in South LA. The residents there called him Green-Eyed Mike.
Working in that housing development, you're dealing with the same people day in and day out. The Bounty Hunter Bloods, you know, they were the primary gang there. And for me, I never had any aversion to talking to people in the community, period, and I really didn't care what affiliation they may have or what their lifestyle they had. I really didn't care. It's just, I just saw a person.
Carradine's style of policing was built on the idea that you treat all people, even gang members, as human beings. And this idea often confounded Carradine's fellow officers.
And I would, to a certain degree, get ostracized by fellow officers. I mean, they would just stare out, ask me, why are you talking to these individuals? They're gang members. And the lines of demarcation were very clear to them. It's like, we're the police. Those are the bad guys. And, you know, we deal with it accordingly.
For him, the world was not so clearly divided between the good guys and the bad guys. As a black kid growing up in South Central, when it was a primarily white neighborhood, Carradine was mistreated by police regularly. They would call him nigger, detain him and his friends for no reason, and they would bluntly tell him, you are not allowed west of Crenshaw. And a few times, they assaulted his friends and his brother.
You knew in our neighborhoods, you knew certain entities that you would prefer to deal with.
Carradine says a lot of people who get mistreated by the police, even if it's just a single incident, develop a lifelong mistrust of law enforcement. But that didn't happen to Carradine. Instead, he saw bad policing as a problem that could be solved.
I've always been a firm believer that if you're going to be critical about something, it does you no good to criticize unless you're going to be proactive in doing something about it.
Lieutenant Carradine has played a big role in the slow changes that have occurred within the LAPD as it's tried to correct many of its failed policies and tactics. Carradine's focus has been on the department's gang intervention program, in which officers work alongside former gang members to curb violence and rebuild the community's trust in law enforcement.
They have a few guys working. It's a lot of work.
A few weeks ago, I visited the LAPD's training center in Inglewood, where a group of about 30 officers were seated in a classroom. The training session, which lasted all day, was part history lesson and part introduction. Veteran officers explained how things used to be done and why those tactics failed. And the officers were introduced to several former gang members who now work with the department as interventionists. Sergeant Curtis Woodall, well over 6 feet, shaved head, well-tailored suit, stood at the front of the room, a PowerPoint presentation projected behind him. And even before he spoke, he radiated confidence and authority. Woodall also worked in South Central in the late 80s and early 90s. He was in the gang suppression unit. He started his presentation to the class by describing how he did police work back then.
and ask any questions. It was more like, what's your name?
Sergeant Woodle punched his open palm loudly to demonstrate how he used to greet people on the street who he deemed suspect.
I wanted to hear that, right? What's your name? And if it wasn't the right name, you know what was coming. That's how we operated. Everybody knew that, from top to bottom.
Woodle then told this story about a day when he and his partner were cruising the neighborhood in their squad car, and they saw a man jogging on the sidewalk.
I just want to talk to this guy. Hey, I'm in my car.
Woodle yelled at the man from the car, but he didn't respond. So the officers pulled up beside him, got out of the car, and they roughed him up, gave him a bloody nose, and put him in handcuffs. And then Woodle discovered that the man he'd just assaulted was deaf. That's why he hadn't responded initially.
Sorry! We laugh about it now, right? But that was normal. And so what I'm saying to you guys is, we didn't correct ourselves.
Sergeant Woodle explained that this aggressive style of policing not only created animosity between the community and law enforcement, it didn't work. Violent crime continued to rise throughout this period of suppression.
It was war, and we were losing it in a lot of ways.
The point of Sergeant Woodle's story is to illustrate just how much LAPD's tactics have changed. Today, the emphasis is on community policing, or as one instructor put it, humanity policing. It's a method of police work that looks strikingly similar to the way Lieutenant Carradine has worked his entire life.
We use the term intervention now, and you can interface that term with community outreach. And I've always had done just that. And I was able to just basically continue doing what I was doing, and now it was being fully recognized and sanctioned by the department.
Intervention is a key part of the LAPD strategy to reduce violence. And it's a hard thing to explain because A, it's complicated, and B, it goes against many of the established roles that cops and criminals have traditionally had. But it's important to understand how it works. And it begins with this basic fact. Many of the people living in places most affected by violence don't trust the police. And the LAPD recognized this, so they partnered with people who have close ties to the community. In this case, these people happen to be former gang members, called interventionists. These interventionists act as first responders to violent crimes. So, for example, there's Skip Townsend, an interventionist who works primarily in the West Adams neighborhood. Whether he's peering out from a hoodie in LA's roughest neighborhoods or adjusting his reading glasses in a boardroom among the city's most powerful elites, Skip operates with ease. He used to be a member of the Rolling Twenties, a set of bloods from the West Adams neighborhood. People there, including current members of the Rolling Twenties, respect and trust Skip. When a shooting occurs in Rolling Twenties territory, Skip will get a call or an email from the LAPD. And even though crime in LA is down since the 90s, people still get shot on a regular basis in South LA.
If it does apply to me, then I am mandated by the city to respond. Whether to respond is via telephone or if it's actually to respond to the scene is determined based on what it is and as the body's been transported.
If the body of the victim is still at the crime scene, Skip will rush straight there. If the victim has been transported to a hospital, Skip might go there instead. Or he might jump on the phone and start making calls. In any of these scenarios, his mission is essentially the same: to find out why this person was shot. Was it gang-related, a dispute over a girl, a robbery? He's trying to determine if this shooting will lead to a retaliatory killing. And if so, how can he stop it? He also acts as a buffer between the police and the community, so that if anyone does have information about the crime, they might be more willing to tell the police.
For example, I pulled up to a scene. It was early morning. One of my community members was shot, and I'm standing out there, and I'm working the crowd, and I'm talking, and the yellow tape is up, and I look down, and I see my phone ringing, and it was Mike Carradine.
Mike Carradine is Green-Eyed Mike, the lieutenant you heard earlier.
And I answered the phone. I said, hey, how's it going, Lieutenant? He said, Skip, I just want to give you a head nod from across the street. And I saw him. He said, yeah, at some point I'll come talk to you. And when he did come out and speak, you know, and give me the information he had, I had other community members there as well to let them know, you know what, it's okay to talk and listen to the police.
For interventionists to do this kind of work, they have to have what's called a license to operate. And the way a license to operate works is each interventionist has their own jurisdiction, a neighborhood where they have close ties to the community, and where they have a reputation for being trustworthy, for not being a snitch.
The license to operate is based on the fact that the community understands the work and understands that no matter what happens, that us as interventionists, we will never try to get a conviction or try to get anyone arrested for something they've done. But also we get a license to operate from law enforcement based on the same things, based on the fact that they trust that any information they give us is being used to stop retaliation.
In other words, interventionists are neutral parties. They're not cops. They're not gang members. And this is a dangerous high wire act. If someone in the community thinks Skip gave up information on someone, it puts his life in danger. Conversely, if the police think Skip might be protecting someone or obstructing justice, this puts his freedom in jeopardy. This is why Lieutenant Carradine plays such a key role in intervention work. He's developed a relationship with Skip to the point where he, as a cop, can vouch for him to other officers in the department who might be skeptical about working with an ex-offender. It's a relationship that's built on the shared experience of growing up in South Central.
We have that common bond right there. You know, we have a common understanding of where we came from and what we were trying to achieve. And I think the key was we both were trying to achieve the same things. It's all about we wanted to see peace in the neighborhoods that we had a connection with and still had a connection with.
By the time that Skip and Carradine met in 2008, Skip had long quit gang life. He had a successful business as a tow truck driver, and he was mentoring youth and volunteering with several anti-violence groups in the community.
Oh, I met Skip, it was 2008. That was the year that the department really started to seriously look and embrace what intervention was. When we first started this, we saw record drops in homicides and gang-related crime overall. Can we say that intervention was the cause? Well, there are a lot of factors that are involved, obviously, with drops in crime, but I have to say that intervention played a role in the overall approach of how to address those crimes.
Carradine still deals with a lot of skepticism that officers have about working with people who once stood on the opposite side of the line of demarcation from the police. He, along with Skip and the other interventionists, are trying to correct the us versus them mentality that has failed the community in the past. Sergeant Woodall put it this way in his closing remarks to the officers in training. Know this, he said. It's important for you guys to win. It's also important for their community to win. If they don't win, we don't win either. I'm David Weinberg for KCRW.
All right, tomorrow we're going to hear more about Skip Townsend, how he went from gang member to gang interventionist. The entire Peacemaker series can be found at belowthe10.com. And finding us right now is Warren Olney, host of To The Point, who's here now to give us a preview. Hi.
I am here, and hi to you. It's nice to see you after a long weekend.
You too.
Or a weekend, anyway. It wasn't all that long.
Filled with lots of things that felt long.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're going to be talking about the efforts that are being made all over the country by Republican legislators to limit the extension of rights to gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transsexuals. It's most dramatic today in Georgia, where the governor vetoed a bill that would have imposed legislation, although it was said to be a compromise. We have a very interesting conversation, I think, with one of the state senators who's in favor of it.
Mm-hmm.
However, in North Carolina, there is a bill, much stronger bill, that went into effect after just 12 hours of debate last week. That's sticking around, but it's not they aren't the only states where all this is going on, and it is an interesting development, I think, that we're going to hear a lot more of as time goes on. It's often used as—religious liberty is often used as the justification for it. Obviously, those in opposed to it think that's fake.
Okay, coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point. Thank you, Warren
Olney.
And on this show, the Oculus Rift arrives today in consumers' homes. Will virtual reality headsets become as ubiquitous as iPhones? That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. You can find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts at our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're tired of reality, and really, who isn't from time to time, virtual reality is now a reality. The first Oculus Rift virtual reality systems are shipping out today. So now that virtual reality is readily accessible, where is it headed? Joining me now is Peter Rubin, senior editor at Wired Magazine. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Madeline.
So you've experienced it for yourself. What do you think? Is it a game changer?
I think so. Then again, I thought that 3 years ago when I saw it for the first time.
Right. But now actual real people can have it in their hands for a mere $600.
It's true. Plus the cost of a PC that's strong enough to run it. So really, you're looking at about $1,500.
And it only runs on PCs?
Only runs on Windows PC.
Okay. So what was it like?
Well, it really depends what you're using. It is what you're using it for, rather. Right now, games are by far the most robust use case for the Rift. But people have seen a sneak preview of what's possible if they have one of the solutions that works off of a smartphone like Google Cardboard or Samsung Gear VR. Mm-hmm. Each of those gives some sort of teaser of what VR really is, which is it places you in a 360-degree environment. What the Rift does is it adds a number of features that really deepen that immersion. It tracks the headset in space, meaning that if you're sitting at a table in VR, say, and in real life you lean forward, in VR, you would also lean forward and you would get closer to the objects on the table. You can change your angle of perspective, examine things from various angles. And so it's really used to its strongest effect in kind of CGI rendered environments like a video game or similar.
And do these games, do they come with the headset or do you buy them separately? How do you get them?
A little bit of both. It does come with two games and a number of other experiences. One of the games that it comes with is called Lucky's Tale, and it's kind of a Super Mario-style platformer game, but it places you in the world. So you're controlling the character, but you are also in this kind of fantastic cartoonish environment, and it's really sweet and really fun. And there's also a much more kind of adult outer space dogfighting game where you pilot a spaceship along with a number of other people. But there are also other things that come with the Rift. Two kind of movie-like experiences that were developed by Oculus's, quote, storytelling division, Oculus Story Studios. These are kind of short, Pixar-like animated features that bring you into the space to follow a short narrative. And then there's also a number of other things you can do as well. You can stream 360-degree videos. You can watch Vimeo or Twitch in a virtual theater. But by and large, games are the most plentiful thing in the store.
And there's nothing for your hands, right?
Not as of yet. It comes with a small remote control that you can use to navigate through some of the experiences, and it also comes with an Xbox controller for use with the more involved games. However, later in the year, Oculus is going to be releasing what's called Oculus Touch, and it's two handheld controllers that bring your hands into VR. This has been something that media and developers have been able to experience for close to a year now, but it'll be coming to consumers for use with the Rift at some point later in the year.
Wow. Okay. So meanwhile, there's, as you mentioned, the Samsung Gear VR, and that's for, you can buy that headset for just $100 and you put your Samsung Galaxy smartphone in it. They are developing a studio in New York to develop films, I guess, or some kind of content to go with it. Do you see this as a big competition between these two?
Between the Gear and the Oculus Rift?
Yeah.
Well, funnily enough, they both have Oculus behind them. I mean, Oculus helped Samsung develop the headset for use with Samsung phones, and in return, Samsung furnished Oculus with custom displays for use in their Rift. So it's really a one hand washing the other. Oculus knows that while the Rift and a PC-driven solution is going to be much more powerful and deliver much stronger immersion, mobile headsets like the Gear VR are going to be absolutely necessary to get VR in as many hands, or maybe more accurately, on as many faces as possible in the coming months.
And then there's HTC, is it Vive?
The Vive, yeah.
Vive. And PlayStation also coming out with VR headsets.
Yes, both of those coming in 2016, so it's going to be a busy year.
What do you think about this? Is this going to be the next big thing technology-wise, or is it going to be a little bit like Google Glass?
I think the former. You know, there is someone that I spoke to months and months ago, works in Silicon Valley as a venture capital investor, and he says he's seen a handful of demos throughout his life that has let him know that things were about to change irrevocably. One was seeing the first Macintosh computer. The other was seeing Netscape, the first web browser. Another was seeing the iPhone. And the most recent one was seeing an early version of the Oculus Rift. This what's interesting about virtual reality and its cousin augmented reality is we're so used to experiencing things through a frame, through some sort of a rectangle or window, whether it's your phone or a movie screen or a television or a monitor. With this family of technologies called mixed reality, you are going through the frame and you're in something new. So there, some people are referring to this as the final platform, because where can you go from here when you can be in a virtual space and have a meeting with other people, or stack three computer monitors side by side in order to do your work while you're sitting at an empty desk in real life? There's almost no shortage of the things you can imagine, and it goes so far beyond entertainment into healthcare and education and relationships and social networks. It's hard to imagine this not touching every aspect of our life.
Wow. Mind blown. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Rubin, senior editor at Wired Magazine. Jolie Myers, regular reality is going to be so boring in comparison.
You know what? Regular reality is something I want to escape at this point. So, so we did a story for our Below the 10 series, which is produced with a grant from the Hilton Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it was a positive portrayal of what's going on in South LA right now. And Alessa Carlino says, thank you for the dose of positivity on this Monday. It's good to hear good stories coming out of South LA. And then speaking of escape, we talked about moving to Canada if the T word wins. And we wondered, why Canada? Why is Canada always the place that we're going to move? Some of our listeners had some other ideas. R.C. Langley says Antarctica. Shaheen Prope says Costa Rica is calling my name. And LS says, well, how about a place where I can be free, otherwise known as the moon?
Okay, thank you, Jolie Myers. We'd love to hear your ideas. Hit us up on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'm going to move into my next reality now. I'll see you tomorrow.